That's kind of conversation between the soul. That's conversation between the soul and the night.
Hello, Prestige Heads, and welcome to American Prestige. I'm Danny Bessner, here as always with my friend and comrade Derek Davison, and we are excited to bring you the news. Hey everyone, Danny here. Yeah,
that is exciting. Wow, yeah, I am psyched up.
That is exciting. Everyone, I will be on, I have been on Fresh Air by the time you're listening to this to talk about my new Harper's article. So if you haven't listened to that, please check it out. It is found wherever you listen to Fresh Air, probably the internet or the radio. But Derek, we've got a lot of news today. Why don't we start with Congress has passed Biden's war funding package. What are the details of that package and what does that mean?
So our long national nightmare is over, is what it means. This has been, you know, the worst thing that's ever happened in American history is the delay in passing this bill, or this set of bills. Actually, the Senate a couple of months ago passed a single bill that met Biden's war funding demands for about $95 billion in supplementary military aid. The House of Representatives, for arcane political reasons within the Republican Party mostly, split that up into a package of separate bills that nevertheless was all passed. You know, they were all passed together and sent back to the Senate for repassage and then on to Joe Biden, who signed it into law, I believe, Wednesday morning. So, you know, the long national nightmare is over. What's in the deal, what's in the package is funding for Ukraine, for Israel, and for Taiwan, but it's more Taiwan and other Indo-Pacific projects that the United States is undertaking to counter China, you know, China's awful visage in that region. And there's a fourth kind of odds and ends thing that includes a possible ban on TikTok in the United States if TikTok's owners do not sell to a U.S. Company, or one that is deemed acceptable, I guess, by the U.S. government, and also includes authorization for the U.S. government to confiscate around $5 billion in frozen Russian assets that are in the United States in U.S. banks and other institutions to send on to Ukraine, essentially, to just take that money and do with it as we want. Most of the money goes to Ukraine. About $60 billion to $61 billion is earmarked for Ukraine. Most of that for military funding, although some of it will go for budgetary support. And one of the differences, I think, between the House version and the Senate version was that the House made about $10 billion in financial support, somewhere between $9 and $10 billion, into a loan rather than just giving them aid. But it's a loan that can be forgiven at the discretion of the president and almost certainly will be. So it is effectively a grant anyway. About $26 billion is going to Israel and to foreign aid. This is very interesting the way this is being reported. I think it's being done to obfuscate how much of this is military assistance to Israel to help it continue pounding Gaza and massacring the Palestinians. So there's around $26 billion that's kind of in this pool. I think about $17 billion of it is going to Israel, and most of that is for military needs. The rest is earmarked for humanitarian aid. I've seen this reported as though all of that additional $9 billion is going to Gaza. That's not anywhere close to accurate. I think around $1 billion is going to go to Gaza, and then the rest is for other humanitarian aid projects around the world. But it's all in the same bill as the Israel military funding, I think, to just basically obfuscate how much funding is going to Israel. And then, as I said, there's about $8 billion for Indo-Pacific stuff, which includes military aid to Taiwan. So all of these places can expect some new military goodies. In Ukraine's case, it's been several months since they got a substantial tranche of U.S. assistance, and there is a roughly $1 billion arms package that the Pentagon has already worked up in advance of these bills passing, as they were expected to do. And so that should go out pretty quickly. Israel's been getting steady support, and Taiwan, you know, is sort of in here as a, I think, secondary thing. It's the urgency is more for Ukraine and to a lesser extent Israel.
So, Derek, my understanding is that obviously this aid package wasn't passed especially easily. Does this portend?
It wound anything? Up. I mean, once it came to a vote, the votes were pretty lopsided in both the House,
right. But
Senate,
in terms of
it's this rule that the Republicans, House Republicans, have where they resist bringing something to the floor if it doesn't have majority support within the Republican caucus, and there is a sizable cadre of Republicans who object, especially to Ukraine aid. And that's partly because Donald Trump objects to Ukraine aid, and these guys follow his lead. But, you know, that was really the source of the tension. And it continues to be a source of tension.
Right. That was my question. That, yeah.
You know, the Speaker of the House, Mike Johnson, may find himself being challenged and, you know, at risk of losing his job over this. You know, my heart bleeds, really.
So does this portend anything? Is this going to be difficult every time these aid packages come up? Or do you think that this was a unique fluke situation and it's just going to pass next time? Because Ukraine's going to need more money. Israel's going to need more money. Taiwan's going to need more money.
Yeah, I mean, the Ukraine funding, based on the patterns that we've seen, could probably get Ukraine through this year. $60 billion, that seems in line with what the U.S. has been sending annually. You know, and at that point, it becomes a matter of how the election plays out. If Trump wins, then it's not even going to be an issue. I don't think he'll want to ask for more military aid for Ukraine. If Biden is reelected and the Democrats take the House, which seems within the realm of possibility, then I don't think you're going to see a problem, even if the Senate goes Republican, which also seems to be well within the realm of possibility. Senate Republicans have consistently been, you know, more, I mean, you know, they're older, they're more establishment, less, you know, Trumpist. So they've been consistently kind of supportive of Ukraine funding. So I think if the election breaks in that way, with Democrats taking the House and holding onto the White House, you won't see this kind of fuss about the next package.
Thanks. Let's talk about Israel, which is preparing to invade Rafah. And this has been something we've been talking about for a while. So why do you think this is a real preparation for invasion, or is it not?
Well, I think probably this is going to happen here. And the question is, what's the plan in terms of, I hesitate to say in terms of evacuating civilians, because I don't think that's actually going to happen, but in terms of making a show of evacuating civilians, what is the Israeli plan here? But a number of outlets have reported this week, Reuters cited a senior Israeli defense official, whatever that means, saying that the IDF is ready to go. Like, they just need the green light from the government. They're ready to go into Rafah. There's been satellite imagery reported in a couple of places, Al Jazeera, the AP, that shows a couple of things. It shows the IDF massing vehicles in the Negev Desert, which is, you know, one of the places they would certainly enter Rafah from, and also to the north of Gaza. So it looks like they're preparing to go back in a big way.
And thanks for joining us. Israel's army says it is now fully prepared to launch a ground operation into Rafah, the only city in Gaza it has not yet raided. It claims Rafah is the last Hamas bastion. It is also an overcrowded city where over a million Palestinian civilians have taken refuge after Israel's siege forced them from their homes further north. And now satellite images show what look like two tent encampments nearby.
The other bit of satellite imagery showed tents going up in Khan Yunis. Now, there's some dispute about what this means. The report that I saw from, I think it was the AP, said that they had been told by a Palestinian official that the tents were going up just to accommodate people in Khan Yunis who have been displaced by IDF activity in that city. However, it certainly does seem coincidental that a bunch of new tents would be going up in a place that could be an area to which the Israelis attempt to evacuate the civilian population of Rafah as they're, you know, kind of moving in. And as I say, the question then becomes, like, what's the plan? Is it to simultaneously start invading Rafah while you're moving people out? Is it to start moving people out and give that like a week or 2 weeks? The Israelis say they need a month, basically, to get the civilian population out. I think that's impossible. If they had a year, I'm not sure they could do it under present conditions. So a month is nothing. But, you know, are they going to go give it 2 weeks and then go in? Are they going to go give it the whole month to say that, you know, we really made a college try at this? I don't know. So that's the question in terms of how imminent the actual invasion may be. We just don't have an idea what the plan is.
Let's talk about this pier that the United States is set to build.
This is Joe Biden's big plan. He announced it in the State of the Union that the pier, you know, the U.S. Navy and the U.S. military is going to go in and build this offshore pier, you know, that will be used to bring humanitarian, to flood Gaza with humanitarian aid. That's the story. We learned this week there was a piece in The Guardian that had UN officials basically calling the pier a smokescreen, and a smokescreen primarily to cover the suffering that's going to be caused by the Rafah invasion. And the reason that they're saying this is because when Biden announced this thing, it was supposed to be a way to get around Israeli blockades and to deliver aid to Gaza to meet the already critical need. The thinking at the time, the assumption at the time, I think, was that the pier would go up off the coast of northern Gaza, where the need is greatest, where people are struggling. You know, there's just very little humanitarian aid reaching these people, even after Israeli promises to open up additional checkpoints, et cetera. But it turns out that the pier is going to be built, at least according to this Guardian piece, is going to be built at Israeli urging, off the shore of the Netzarim corridor, which is the secured area that the IDF has set up that cuts a swath through the middle of Gaza. And then, you know, from there, it could be diverted anywhere. It could be diverted specifically to the south to try to account for the new need that's going to be created by the Rafah operation, while the people in northern Gaza would still be suffering with little to no humanitarian aid. So that's the concern. The plan is to have it up and running, assuming that it actually gets up and running, within a couple of weeks, I believe. When Biden announced that, the Pentagon said it needed 60 days to do this. Most of that time has been spent getting materials into place, getting ships into place to begin construction. I think now they're waiting to make sure that there is some aid there's going to be some aid that comes on shore once they have it built. So they're trying to organize all these things, and then the construction is supposed to take a couple of weeks.
All right, let's talk about Antony Blinken, the guitarist, who might blacklist an
famous
IDF
blues
unit.
Guitarist Antony Blinken,
who's also the Secretary of State. Turns out,
I didn't know that. I just know him from his albums,
from his work,
his work. Yeah. This was there was a report in ProPublica last week that I think really embarrassed the Biden administration. It basically said that Blinken has been told by offices within the State Department about Israeli military units and police units that have committed serial human rights violations. Under the Leahy Law, which has been around since the late 1990s, the U.S. government is required. It's not just like you can do this, you have the authorization to do it. You are required to assess the human rights performance and adherence of foreign military units that receive U.S. aid, U.S. weapons, et cetera. And if they are found to be credibly accused, I think credibly accused is the standard, of human rights violations, then the U.S. government is obliged to cut them off. And so this report in ProPublica basically accused Blinken and Biden of breaking the law, that they're just sitting on this information. They've been told about these rights violations and they're doing nothing about it. And so within a couple of days, Blinken was giving a press conference, and he did some kind of wink, wink, nudge, nudge thing, like, oh, yeah, we're going to be taking some action here. Just you wait. And then the Biden administration leaked to Barak Ravid at Axios, who's one of their favorite conduits for this sort of thing, that the State Department is going to be blacklisting under the Leahy law, is going to be blacklisting the Netzeh Yehuda Battalion of the IDF. Netzeh Yehuda is a battalion that was set up specifically to allow ultra-Orthodox, you know, Jewish Israelis to serve in the military. As you know, Danny, there's controversy over this because a lot of the ultra-Orthodox don't want to serve there in, you know, yeshiva study, and they believe that should exempt them. And there have been exemptions, although that's a great deal of, creates a great deal of controversy politically. So Netzeh Yehuda was created as kind of this hybrid unit that would allow people to, these people to serve in the military while still continuing their studies and continuing their religious obligations in a way to try to find a compromise. They have committed so many human rights violations, or been accused, let's say, of so many human rights violations in the West Bank against Palestinians, that in 2023, the Israeli government said, okay, we're going to transfer you guys to the Golan. To get you out of. So even the Israeli government knows that this is a problem. And it's sort of the lowest hanging fruit, I think, for the Biden administration to say, look, see, we did something. We actually followed through on this law that we're supposed to be upholding. Even the suggestion, however, of a blacklisting, which, you know, would be a token gesture, might not even be enforceable. It's unclear whether the U.S. military has the capacity to kind of track where its weapons go once they get to Israel, and whether they go to specific units, or what they might even do if the IDF just says, screw you, we're going to keep giving these guns to this unit anyway. So you're not even sure this could be enforced, but just the suggestion that this group could be designated under the Leahy law caused just huge outcry from Benjamin Netanyahu, Benny Gantz, a lot of senior people in Israeli politics, just over, you know, what a scandal this would be and how dare you. And I will note that the administration hasn't actually moved on this yet. All we have are these leaks and reports that something is going to happen. It has not actually happened yet.
All right, Derek, now on to some incredibly grim news. Could you tell us about these mass graves that have been discovered in Gaza?
Yes, there have been discoveries of mass graves. Civil defense units in Gaza say they've discovered mass graves at Nasser Hospital in Khan Yunis, at Shifa Hospital in Gaza City, both of which were besieged and attacked by the IDF, I think Shifa Hospital, on two separate occasions.
Well, the UN's human rights chief has said that he was horrified by reports of mass graves found at the site of the Al-Shifa and Nasser medical facilities in Gaza. Palestinian officials claim to have found mass graves with more than 200 bodies in them following Israeli military operations. The UN Human Rights Office said that it's working to corroborate the reports.
The one that's gotten the most attention has been the mass grave at Nasser Hospital, where I believe they're up to over 300 bodies. I don't have the latest count, but they were up to 280 bodies as of Monday, and I believe it's over 300 now, maybe even higher than that. At this point, that they've pulled out of this mass grave at Nasser Hospital. A number of the bodies show indications of having been people having been tortured, of hands and feet being bound and then having been summarily executed. The Israeli government is insisting that the IDF had nothing to do with this, and I mean. What else could it be, really? There were reports of mass executions going on at Nasser Hospital during the Israeli assault, a short time, a few weeks ago. So we had witnesses claiming that this was going on, and the evidence in the mass grave certainly seems to back that up. I don't know what else to say about it other than to note that it's there, because I don't think there will be any repercussions from it, certainly for the Israelis.
So what's been going on in Iraq and Syria? It appears that U.S. forces have been under attack there.
Yes. There was a base in northeastern Syria that came under fire on Sunday, rocket fire from a launcher near a town in northern Iraq. A few hours later, there were reports that Assad Air Base in western Iraq had come under some sort of drone strike that U.S. forces stationed there had shot down a couple of drones that were attacking the facility. Both of these taken together, assuming that they're deliberate, and interestingly, the Pentagon initially said there was some possibility that the rocket launch was accidental, that there was some kind of malfunction of a rocket launcher in Iraq, and these missiles just kind of started firing in all directions. But they seem to have gone back on that and are suggesting that, that this was intentional. So it suggests that Iraqi militias are once again attacking U.S. personnel in Iraq and Syria. I don't know why the change. There haven't been any of those incidents since early February after the incident in Jordan when the U.S. carried out some airstrikes against Iraqi militia positions, and the militias kind of quieted down for a time. So I don't know why the resumption, although there was a message that circulated on Telegram purportedly from Kataib Hezbollah, which is the most prominent of the Iraqi militias, that claimed that the militias were going to start attacking U.S. soldiers again because of delays in negotiating a U.S. withdrawal from Iraq, which the Iraqi government has suggested it would be interested in doing. Kataib Hezbollah, though, later disclaimed this statement. They called it fake news, basically. They said it wasn't us. It was on a Telegram channel that's linked with the militia, apparently, but they're saying they had nothing to do with it, and they had nothing to do with these attacks.
American Prestige is brought to you in partnership with The Nation magazine. Please consider becoming a subscriber at AmericanPrestigePod.com/subscribe. As a subscriber, you'll get access to dozens of exclusive bonus episodes, including breaking news specials, deep dives into regional histories, analysis of movies and video games, and much more. And if you subscribe at the founders level, you'll be able to claim a year digital subscription to The Nation. Thank you for listening, and now back to the show.
Let's talk about the IDF's small retaliation against Iran.
Yes, we were waiting all week last week for the IDF to retaliate for that Iranian airstrike against Israel, and it finally came kind of overnight into Thursday, into Friday, in the form of a drone strike, apparently, against the Iranian city of Isfahan, or the area, military bases, military facilities around Isfahan. This seems to have been a very small strike. The Iranian media, the Iranian government, all downplayed it very heavily. They said there were three drones involved, and they intercepted all three of them. There have been some, I think, satellite images that show maybe some damage to a radar facility in Isfahan, an Iranian military facility in Isfahan. But nothing serious, no casualties. And so this seems to have been the Israeli kind of last word, that was undertaken with an intent to say, this is all, we don't need to escalate any further. And that's where they seem to be. There's no indication that the Iranian government is planning to retaliate again. Really, there's not much to retaliate for. And so, on the plus side, I guess this particular round of escalation seems to be over without everything kind of spiraling into a regional war, which, most people seem to want to avoid. I can't speak for Benjamin Netanyahu himself or anything like that, but most people seem to want to avoid that.
So that is basically your analysis. The U.S. and Iran don't want it, and it's not like everyone in Israel is braying for a regional war with Iran. That's why this was avoided, because it did seem like this could be an escalatory spiral.
Right. I mean, the feeling seems to be now, or the suspicion seems to be that the Israelis traded they got the U.S. to get off their backs about Rafah and about the potential civilian cost in exchange for not doing anything more provocative to Iran that might spark a retaliation and continued escalation. So that's my suspicion, is that there was a quid pro quo there, but there's no, I mean, obviously the U.S. and Israeli governments are not going to acknowledge that, even if there was.
Yeah. Let's talk about some potential good news, which is that Azerbaijan and Armenia appear to have been making progress in terms of peace talks.
Yes, maybe. So officials from both Armenia and Azerbaijan on Tuesday installed a border marker, which doesn't seem like that big a deal, but it is quite significant for these two countries, who have never actually demarcated their post-Soviet border. Now, there are provincial maps from Soviet days that show where the border was. But since the collapse of the Soviet Union, when these two countries became independent, they have never sat down and sort of just delineated their border. And there are a number of areas that consequently have been in dispute. And it's one of the major factors, aside from Nagorno-Karabakh, which is now, I guess, settled now that it's been cleansed of its Armenian population. The Azerbaijani demand for a transit corridor to connect to Nakhchivan, which would have to run through Armenian territory. Those are, also issues. But the border has been one of the big kind of sticking points in this relationship and, has caused a number of cross-border incidents. Soldiers have been killed. Border guards have been killed. You know, there's been shelling, shooting, et cetera. So even just getting one border marker down seems like a pretty significant development here. This was made possible by the Armenian government's decision to, and they came to this agreement with Azerbaijan to hand over four border villages that had been part of Azerbaijan. They were seized by Armenian forces during their war, their war over Karabakh, really, in the early 90s. All four sit strategically very close to an important highway that runs through Armenia and connects Armenia to Georgia. So there was a lot of reticence about giving them up, but the Azerbaijani government has been insistent that it wants these villages back. Armenia, having very little leverage at this point and wanting to avoid a war with Azerbaijan, the Armenian government decided to hand these villages over. And that appears to have unlocked this progress on the border. Now, there's been a lot of criticism leveled at Armenian Prime Minister Nikol Pashinyan over the decision to turn these villages over to Azerbaijan for essentially vapor. It's a promise from the Azerbaijanis that there will be progress toward a peace deal. But with that said, the criticism has been real, but this progress on demarcating the border could signify that they are, in fact, making progress toward a peace deal. So maybe that will bear out Pashinyan's decision to hand the villages over. At any rate, I don't think he had a lot of leverage to hold on to them anyway at this point. So he was kind of stuck either way.
Thanks, Derek. Let's talk about Myanmar, where the rebels have withdrawn from Miyawati.
Yes, there was a report earlier this week on Tuesday that we've covered this, in past weeks, that the Karen National Union rebel group, which has been working with local anti-junta militias, had abandoned Miyawati, which they seized earlier this month. We talked about this. It's an important commercial crossing point along the Myanmar-Thai border. What seems to have happened, this is according to the AP, another Karen militant group, which is affiliated with the government, has worked with the government in the past. According to the AP, and I guess, through Karen National Union sources or local sources, what seems to have happened is that the Myanmar soldiers who were stationed in and around Miyawati, who retreated from their positions when the rebels advanced, were sheltered by this other group, which calls itself the Karen National Army now. They used to be called the Border Patrol Guard. I think they were a paramilitary group, but they've changed their name. They sheltered the soldiers and then kind of walked them back into town so that they could, retake their outpost just on the outskirts of Miyawati. And that's what happened on Tuesday. They raised the national flag over the facility, took photographs. It's unclear if they stayed. They might have just gone into to do that, to demonstrate, make some demonstration and then leave again. But apparently the Karen National Union decided that it just wasn't worth holding on. There was too much risk holding on to the town, to its fighters. And so it just wasn't worth the potential cost. So they pulled out to more defensible positions in the area. But still, this leaves Miyawati kind of in limbo. I don't know who's running the town at this point. And as I say, this is a huge checkpoint. It does, a very large amount of commerce that travels between Myanmar and Thailand travels through Miyawati. So something to keep an eye on.
So the United States has finally agreed to pull its forces from Niger. What happened there?
Yes. I mean, all this time since the Nigerians last month asked the U.S. to pull out, or didn't really ask, they tore up their military cooperation agreement, said they would no longer honor it, which you know, was more of a demand that the U.S. Leave the country. The Biden administration has been doing this kind of play dumb thing where it's seeking clarification, and we're just not sure what they mean when they tell us to get the hell out of here. And that's been supposedly cover for, apparently kind of a cover for a diplomatic push to try and get the junta that's ruling Niger to reconsider and allow U.S. forces to stay. Niger is the hub of the Pentagon's West African operations, counterterrorism, surveillance, et cetera. And it's not easily replaced. So they've been trying kind of this Hail Mary effort to get the junta to reconsider. But finally, the New York Times reported on Friday, a few other outlets followed, and then the Pentagon confirmed it on Monday that they have finally agreed to withdraw.
U.S. media reports say Washington has agreed to withdraw troops from Niger. The base in the West African country has been key in counterterrorism efforts in the Sahel region, but Niger's ruling junta canceled a military cooperation agreement with Washington last month and demanded the troop withdrawal.
So negotiations are set to begin, may already have begun. They were set to begin sometime this week on the details in terms of a timetable and the speed with which forces would be withdrawn and how they'll be withdrawn. I mean, there's a lot of logistics that go into to something like that. I think there may still be some hope on the part of the Biden administration that while this kind of drawn out process of negotiating the withdrawal is going on, they could maybe convince the junta, or the junta could be, could change its mind, or there could be some other kind of settlement reached that would allow the U.S. to leave some kind of force, maybe just a drone base. It does have a major drone base in Agadez. Maybe some smaller U.S. contingent could remain. That's complicated by the fact that the junta has welcomed in Russian forces. They're bringing in Russian military aid, weapons, and they've welcomed a number of trainers, quote unquote trainers, Russian forces that will help the Nigerians learn how to use this hardware. It's doubtful that the U.S. and Russia could coexist like that in Niger. So I think this is a pipe dream, but I do get the sense that there's still some hope of salvaging this situation in some way.
So we did an episode with the great Mark Ames on the Russia-Ukraine war. So for details, please check that out. But Derek, could you give us a brief update on what's been happening in that war?
The Russian military has made some advances in recent days. They've captured a couple of Ukrainian villages, three of them, I believe, since the weekend. One of them, Bohdanivka, is located really on the outskirts of Chasiv Yar, which is an important strategic town in Donetsk. It's got kind of a strategic position. This puts the Russians really like right on the brink of going in and taking this town from the Ukrainians. And if they take Chasiv Yar, they have an open road potentially. I mean, it depends on how quickly the Ukrainians can regroup. But there are larger cities, Kramatorsk to the west that if the Russians take Chasiv Yar, they could continue pushing in that direction toward these, larger cities that also serve as logistical hubs for the Ukrainian military. Also, at the same time, on a different front, around Avdiivka, the Chasiv Yar is sort of the next thing, next major town to the west after Bakhmut. So that's in one part of the front line. Around Avdiivka, which the Russians took in February, there were reports, and it seems to be the case, that over the weekend the Russians seized another village called Ocheretinye. I hope I'm not mangling that too badly. There's a couple of reasons that this is significant. One, as was the case with Bohdanivka and Chasiv Yar, Ocheretinye sits on the road from Avdiivka, or sits on the way from Avdiivka to the city of Pokrovsk, which is to the west, another hub, another important logistical hub for the Ukrainian military. So that's significant. But also, Otradnitynia is like several kilometers into what was assumed to be the Ukrainian defensive line that they set up after they pulled out of Avdiivka. It suggests that the Russians have breached that defensive line. I mean, that they've really advanced quite a ways into it compared to, you know, how things have been moving over the last several months, which has been, you know, meters at a time. This is, you know, they, like they've moved several kilometers. So that's a potentially, you know, interesting development that, that could be followed up on, but we'll have to wait and see.
Thanks, Derek. Let's talk about what the U.S. is doing with regards to Ukraine in terms of long-range weapons and negotiating a military agreement.
Yes, this is a big revelation. On Wednesday, the Biden administration acknowledged that it has already started sending long-range Army tactical missile systems to Ukraine. The Ukrainian military apparently used them in an April 17th strike on a Russian airbase in Crimea that they initially tried to say was done with homemade weapons. The Army tactical missile system works with these multiple rocket launch vehicles that the U.S. has already been sending, the HIMARS vehicles that the U.S. has sent to Ukraine. It has, we knew that the Biden administration was sending sort of the medium range version of these things, which has a top range of about around 160 kilometers. But the Ukrainians had been requesting, demanding, whatever, the long-range version of the Army tactical missile system, which has a top range of around 300 kilometers. The Biden administration had publicly been resisting this, mostly, I think, for fear that it would be used to attack targets in Russia, but apparently caved in last month. This was part of a small package of weapons that the U.S. sent in March. Without telling anybody, without it, you know, saying anything, they did it secretly. There will presumably be more of these weapons included in that $1 billion arms package that I mentioned at the beginning of the show, that the Pentagon has prepared, and or that the Pentagon did prepare in advance of the supplemental military funding bill. Additionally, earlier this week, during one of his evening addresses, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said that the Ukrainian and U.S. governments are working on a bilateral security agreement. Now, this is not a mutual defense alliance. It would not require the U.S. to intervene directly in the war. I mean, you know, or more directly, I guess. It would probably look like the same arrangement, the similar arrangements that the Ukrainian government has negotiated with France, Germany, and the U.K., which are 10-year commitments, basically, for these countries to continue supporting the Ukrainian military. They're meant more, I think, symbolically to show the Russians that the West isn't going anywhere, that its commitment to Ukraine is not going to waver, even though it clearly has wavered. So, you know, it's more symbolic than anything else, but, you know, worth, I think, mentioning.
Thanks, Derek. Let's talk about Haiti, where Ariel Henry has resigned.
Yes, this just happened on Thursday, so I don't have a ton of details. The Haitian Transitional Council that the Caribbean community and the U.S. have been kind of trying to birth into existence, finally, the members of it finally assumed office on Thursday. They had a small ceremony in the prime ministerial residence on the outskirts of Port-au-Prince. This is after they spent most of the week preparing to have a big ceremony at the National Palace in Port-au-Prince. They were unable to do that because the area around the National Palace is largely controlled by insurgents or gangs, whatever you want to classify them as. And Haitian police were apparently unable to secure the area in time to have the ceremony. So coincident with the ceremony and the installation of the council, Ariel Henry submitted his resignation. He apparently sent a letter on Wednesday that was made public on Thursday saying that he would resign. He's been replaced on an interim basis by Michel Patrick Boisvert. I'm probably mangling that. My French, as you know, is not good. But he's been the finance minister under Henry, and he's been sort of de facto running whatever exists of the Haitian government while Henry has been, as we've talked about for several weeks now, stranded in the U.S., unable to return because of the insurgent violence at Port-au-Prince. So he's just, they're just kind of making it official that he is now the interim prime minister. He will work with the transitional council, which at some point will appoint it seems like they will appoint a more definite, like, not non-interim prime minister, although even that person is presumably only going to be in the office to try and organize an election, which I'm not sure can be done under the circumstances anyway. But, you know, things are, as always, very nebulous in Haitian politics. So that's where things stand. Henri is gone, which, you know, could quiet some of these, some of the insurgent violence, which was directed specifically at ousting Henri. But I don't think the leaders of the insurgency are particularly enamored with this transitional council. Many of them have demanded that they have some say in whatever happens to the Haitian government moving forward. And they're not getting that with this council, which, again, was formed with not that much Haitian input. I mean, it was formed by the Caribbean community and the U.S.
So let's do a new Cold War update, and let's start with Blinken's visit to China.
Yeah, Antony Blinken is in China. He arrived on Wednesday. This is the latest high-level kind of visit by a U.S. official to China. I'm not entirely clear what's exactly is on the agenda. Reporting suggested that he would go in hoping to lecture the Chinese government or lecture his Chinese counterparts into reducing their support for the Russian military. Now, China isn't sending weapons to Russia, but it does send electronics and other so-called dual-use items that support the Russian defense industry. I don't think Blinken's going to get very far with that. You know, not only is it patronizing to for him to go in and try to tell the Chinese government what to do, but Chinese officials apparently get very testy, specifically about Ukraine, when their U.S. counterparts bring up Ukraine in the context of U.S.-Chinese relations. They don't like that very much. The visit may also be a little bit rocky because of the passage of the supplemental military aid bill and this $8 billion that's going to various anti-China projects in the Indo-Pacific, and specifically to military aid for China. Obviously, Beijing doesn't like that either. But what kind of stands out to me, and there was a piece Responsible Statecraft by Jake Werner of Quincy about this. What stands out is that there doesn't really seem to be much of an agenda to, like, talk about any of the issues that confound the U.S.-Chinese relationship, or issues that the U.S. and China should be working collaboratively on, like climate change. It seems to be a trip that they're doing just for the sake of having a trip, for the sake of having the U.S. Secretary of State in China, to kind of show that things are that the relationship is going okay, at least well enough to have that kind of high level interaction, which is fine. It's better than not talking at all, certainly. But at some point, there's going to have to be some willingness to do more than showy diplomatic events and actually get into some of the issues in the relationship, or else, you know, I don't see any improvement on the horizon here.
So we'll be paying attention to that story. And let's conclude with some terrible news. Why don't you tell us about Joe Biden's uncle, Derek?
Yes, this is very sad breaking news from World War II. Joe Biden, last week, he was in Pennsylvania at some sort of war memorial, and he decided to tell the story of his uncle, a man named Ambrose Finnegan, who was a pilot in the Army Air Force in World War II. Now, Biden's story is that he was shot down near New Guinea during World War II. The U.S. military says that he was the passenger on a plane that crashed near New Guinea in 1944. It does not say that it was shot down or, you know, that it went down in any kind of a combat situation or due to enemy fire. But where he really kind of went off the rails here in his speech is Biden said that the body, his uncle's body, was never discovered. And, you know, I'm going to just quote Biden here. They never found the body because there were a lot of cannibals for real in that part of New Guinea. That is amazingly a quote from his remarks. this caused a bit of a stir. The Prime Minister of Papua New Guinea, James Marape, was not pleased with Biden's implication that his uncle was eaten by cannibals in New Guinea. He issued a statement, you know, kind of criticizing the implication, also pointing out correctly that the people of New Guinea never asked the United States and Japan et al. To bring World War II to their country, but they did it anyway. Now, Marape has since downplayed any sort of rift in the relationship, but Papua New Guinea is of huge importance in the new Cold War kind of construct for political influence and control in the Pacific region. The U.S. has put a lot into developing its relationship with Papua New Guinea to try and keep it from spinning away from the U.S. and Australia and toward China. So this is just fascinating that you would tell a story about cannibals in this country eating your uncle and not expect that to have any diplomatic repercussions. Good for President Biden. I hope he tells more family lore stories like this about people being, abducted by aliens or something as we go forward in the campaign.
It's a goddamn shame we're not going to have debates this year. Well, everyone, thank you for listening. Derek, thank you, and we'll see you all soon. Bye.
Bye.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.